Take me where the promises are real.
Let's have an AA meeting.
Let's have one.
My name is Stephanie, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Stephanie.
Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of the membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. So help me welcome our speaker, Maggie N.
Hi, I'm Maggie. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic.
Hi.
Thank you so much for asking me to speak. I have to be full disclosure. She has actually never heard my story, so it's going to be kind of exciting to see how the next hour turns out. So my sobriety date is December 29th, 1995, which makes 26 years and so many months. So I would love to say, but, you know, so what happened over last weekend, we went to the prepaid convention down in Dublin, and they have the countdown. And I stood up at 27 years opposed to 26 years. Because even now, I still don't know what I'm doing. So, and I didn't realize that till like yesterday afternoon. I was like, you know, oh my God, I stood up at the wrong time. But anyway, so, but I do have a home group. My home group is the Turin Lost and Found group. It is, if you're not familiar with the town of Turin, it's because it has a post office and an antique shop and a church. And we meet in the church. My name is the Methodist Church. And I have a sponsor who has a sponsor, and they all believe in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And from the grace of God and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I am standing here today, because it certainly is not because of the way Maggie ran her life. And so what I do is I normally try to tell my story backwards. So I will get to the drunkalogue. But I try to save that to the end, and I can kind of get a little wordy, so I do want to stop at an appropriate time. So I came into AA because my life was just not working, and I was going to therapy because my life wasn't working, and all my girlfriends were going to therapy, and they all seemed to be graduating, and we all had the same therapist, and I would go to therapy, and I said to her, you know, why are they all graduating, and I'm still in here? And she's like, well, you know, I have no idea what she said. But all of a sudden, I know that every time I would try to explain all the problems in my life, she would want to talk about alcohol. And I'm like, that has nothing to do with this issue. And so one Saturday morning, I was in her office, and I agreed that I would go to an AA meeting. Now, I want you to know, it's not that I didn't know I was alcoholic. I mean, I come from an alcoholic background. I mean, my family is, I mean, you know, you'll look up alcoholic in the dictionary, and we're all in there. And so, so this one Saturday morning, it happens to be the Saturday between Christmas and New Year's, and that just tells you right there how crazy my thinking was, so that I would agree to go to an AA meeting before New Year's, you know. And so I agreed, and my girlfriend was in the lobby waiting for me to get out of therapy, and I said that I would go to an AA meeting. And the minute I said that, she said, 90 meetings in 90 days. I was like, for God's sake, I'm like, I just agree that I would not drink for 30 days, and I would go to an AA meeting. And so I get rushed out into the lobby. She starts talking to my girlfriend, and next thing you know, we're on our way over to the Triangle Club. My therapist actually, it's kind of funny, I was just thinking this the other day, she actually lived in this area. So, and I'm very grateful for her calling that she would have stuck with me. And anyway, we went to the Triangle Club, and yeah, if you've ever been there on a Saturday, there was like just a ton of people. There was a ton of people, and there were people making coffee, and so we got in, we sat in the back of the room, we left, I don't know when we left, I don't remember anything about it, but I do know that there is an AA meeting. This is what I know. And so I didn't realize the severity of the disease of alcoholism that I had at that time, and, you know, I just didn't understand. So when she was trying to talk me into going to meetings, I'm like, you know, I have stopped drinking, and I went to a meeting. I think everyone should be very happy with this. So I came a couple of days, and I agreed. So I decided I would go back to another meeting. I go back to the meeting at the Triangle Club, and now it's a 1:30 Monday afternoon meeting, and I pull into the parking lot, and there's not one car in the parking lot. And to me, that's a sign from God. And so I'm thinking, well, really, if I really need to be going to AA, people would be here. So God and I make this deal. And so I say, and I had $3 in my pocket. And at that time, that's about how much a six-pack would cost. So I make the deal that I'll go into the, I'll go pull on the door, and if the door don't open, then I'll go buy some beer, and if it's unlocked, I'll go in. And so I'm happy with the deal. God's happy with the deal. Up the steps I go. So I pull on the door, and the damn door opened, and I was like, damn. So I stepped in expecting to see people and like coffee, you know, because it was nothing. It was like there was nothing happening in that little foyer. And so I do know that the room that the meeting was in the other day was through the next set of doors. So God and I came up with this next plan, and that I said, well, if there's nobody in there, then that's a sign that I can go drink beer. And God says, this is a good plan. And so the two of us, we come up to this plan, and over to the doors I go, and I pull on it. And if you've never been to the Triangle Club, it's really, it's just a huge room. And it has these big windows. And, I mean, it's been many years since I've been there. But it has these big windows, and it was a bright, sunny day. And they had these white chairs, and it's almost blinding. And so I'm scanning the room for any type of color and nothing, and I'm getting all happy. And as the door is shutting, I see like a little bit of color over in the corner, and I peeked my head in. And I was raised Irish Catholic. Well, I'm not raised Irish. I am Irish, but I was raised Catholic. And when we would cut church, we would always have to go to the church and peek our heads in to see where the priest was so we could report it to show that we weren't cutting church. So that's exactly how I felt. So I peeked my head in, and there's somebody sitting there, and I'm like, I've been caught. So like I hop in, and it's this gentleman who's sitting over in the corner, and he says to me, are you here for an AA meeting? And I of course, I'm so witty, I was like, you know, I nodded. And so he's like, you know, it only takes two people to have an AA meeting. And I'm like, wow. This is like profound stuff. So I sit down, and he says, I guess I'll share first. I'm like, so he starts talking, and he starts sharing, and then he got done, and he's, you know, motioned to me, and I said something very profound, I'm sure. And so as soon as I got done, the door opened, and these other people came in. And there were, you know, it was one really tall guy and these two ladies. And at the end of the meeting, those ladies were like, you know, why don't we exchange numbers and we'll go to some meetings. And, you know, I'll tell you where the meetings are. And so the one woman, her name was Sherry, and she said, you know, I live out in Stone Mountain and there's this women's meeting. Why don't we go to this women's meeting? I think it was like the next day or something. So my cousin actually lived around the block from her when I found out where she lived. So I come up with this plan, you know, so I was going to pick her up before the meeting and we were going to go over to the Clarkson 12-step group. So I think I was off or something. And so I wound up going to the grocery store and at that time, if you needed extra money, you wrote checks. So I wrote checks. Of course, I really needed extra money. So I wrote it over the amount by like $20. And so they gave me $20. I went back to my cousin's, and he wasn't home. So, you know, I used to make spaghetti sauce all the time. And it was an ordeal. It was an event. You know, I would turn on the music. I would pour my red wine, and I would chop and sing and mix. And this is now the first time I'm going to make spaghetti sauce with no red wine. And I don't really know that this is my issue. All I know is that I'm making this spaghetti sauce, and I'm getting really pissed. But I don't know why I'm really pissed. So the sauce gets made, and I didn't even want to eat it, which shows that there was something seriously wrong. So I go to pick up the girl, and I go around the block, and I had to stop for gas, and I have the $20, and I go, and I give the cashier $20, and she gave me change for a $10 bill. And I said, I'm sorry, but I gave you a 20. And she's like, no, you gave me a 10. I'm like, no, I gave you a 20. And so I'm now in the gas station arguing with the cashier, and the girl who I just picked up, who's going to an AA meeting, is in the car, and she sees this issue that's happening inside the gas station. You know, I'm in there yelling, and my arms are going, and she comes running in there, and she's like, what's the matter? I'm like, oh, my God, thank you. I have support. You know, they shortchanged me. I gave them a 20, and they gave me change then, and, you know, I'm not leaving here. I get my money. And she's like, let's just leave. I'm like, what? I am not leaving here until I get my money. So she literally drags me out of there, and I'm like, this is just crap. And so I was just so upset. And so I'm driving. She's telling me I get to the AA meeting. And I'm like, this is not really where I want to go. And so if you've never been to Clarkson, it's another big room. And they do everything in the beginning. And then they separate people into different rooms. And it came time to separate. And she rushes me off into the non-smoking meeting. And she goes into the smoking meeting. And I'm sitting there. And I am just... I could have just flipped a tear. I mean, I was just so mad. And in my opinion, this is what the topic was. How can we piss off Maggie a little more? So that's how the topic came across. So they all start sharing, and they're going around, and it got to the point where it was this one woman, and she had this really high-pitched voice. And the topic obviously must have been, what year was my toughest? And she started sharing that her third year of sobriety was her toughest. And I'm like, so there's a lull in the room, and I decide that it is my time to share. And I tell them, I'm like, you women, you just freaking piss me off. I can't believe you're sitting here talking about your third year where I'm freaking shaking off this chair. And I just let them all have it. And I was like, you know, I'm from Jersey, so I'm thinking I can make it out of this room. You know, I can take them. They're all, old. And so, you know, I get done, and they expect them to hear, we would like you to leave. But instead, the next lady, she says, you know, we're so glad you're here. And I'm like, you know, So I stayed for the rest of the meeting. You know, I didn't know what to do. And so at the end of the meeting, this older woman, she comes up to me and she takes her finger and I'm like, oh, here it comes. I can take her. She's only like 4'8". I'm like, and she points her finger at me and she says, you keep coming back. I'm like, Well, okay. I'll come coming back. And then next thing you know, they're all like, hey, we're going to meet here tomorrow, and we're going to go here. And so next thing you know, I started going to all these freaking meetings with all these people. I had no idea who they were. And so I live in Sonoy, and I didn't really understand the steps or resentments, but I can tell you, I didn't like any of the people in Peachtree City because I used to work at the restaurant, and all those people were just annoying to me. So I wound up going to meetings in Atlanta for quite a few months. And, you know, the big thing then was, oh, you got to get a sponsor, and you got to do a fourth and fifth step, and, you know, and so I didn't want to seem like I wasn't trying, so I had 7 sponsors my first year. And it wasn't all my fault. So the week before my first birthday, my sponsor number 5, I think, and she fired me. And I was like, oh man, you know, and she told me, I mean, she talked all the freaking time. So she told me why she was firing me, so I'm still in therapy, and, you know, I go to my therapist, and I tell her, and she said, well, why did she fire you? I was like, you know, I don't know. And she said, she just called you up and said, we're going to fire, you know, I'm going to fire you, and, you know, and she's like, no, she talked, and she said, well, I want you to call her up. And I was like, no, I don't want to do that, and she's like, I want you to call her up and ask her for coffee and take a pad and paper and write out every word she says and bring it back. All right. So we met in a coffee shop in Virginia Highlands, and so I said, Estelle wants to know why you fired me, and, you know, and she even spoke slowly so I could write everything. I wrote all down, I write back to her, I take it back to Estelle, and Estelle says, read it, what'd she say? I was like, and she said, now, why did she fire you? And I said, I have no idea. What the hell does this shit mean? I mean, I was like, excuse me. I'm like, well, I have no idea what she said. And you see, I just didn't understand. And, you know, I didn't understand why I was going to therapy. I thought I was going to therapy because I was paying someone to listen to me complain. I wasn't planning on working through anything. I mean, I didn't know I had to do the work. It always seemed like it was everyone else's fault, but every time I'd go to therapy, it was always my fault. And now I'm in early sobriety, and every time I talk to these sponsors, everything seemed like it was my fault. I'm like, why is it my fault? I mean, it was just so overwhelming to me. And so, I finally do a fourth and fifth step, and I wound up, I had now over a year, and of course at this time in my life, and I was single, and everybody's like, you can't date in your first year, and so, like, you know, I didn't date. Now I went a whole year and didn't drink, and I thought God was rewarding me, because all of a sudden, like, this beautiful woman walked through the door, and then she was like, hey, what are you doing? Anyway, so I started dating this woman who, yeah, let me tell you. I started dating this woman, and so I started dating her from January to July. My life went from okay. I mean, I came into AA because my life sucked. So now I'm not drinking, and my life got, I would say, you know, I was making an effort. I would say my life was getting better. And then I started dating. And, you know, if you have any type of issues, like trying to find out with, like your, you know, oh, your characters or defects are, all you've got to do is date. So they just come flying out. So by the time July rolled around, my life just seemed so much worse than it was when I was drinking. And my life was so bad that I agreed to go to AA. And now I'm in AA. I'm not even freaking drinking. I don't get a beer or a shot of tequila through all this. And how the hell did I get here? And so this woman, she taught me some really amazing things. And I would love to say that it was really joyous, but it was not. It was really painful. And she was in AA. She had 3 years. Well, she said she had 3 years, but Lord knows. So anyway, she had 3 years, and she would say stuff. And I was like, where does it say that in the literature? And she'd say, you don't know. And I'd be like, well, you know, I didn't. You know, they said, read the book. I read the book, and now I can say, I read the book. But it's a text. You're supposed to study it. And, like, I had no interest in studying it. I just read it. And so, and then she made, like, this, you know, we would have, like, these intimate secrets. And then all of a sudden, like, I couldn't tell anybody these secrets. And then all of a sudden, like, I had all these secrets. And before, I wasn't really a big secret person. I mean, of course, I had my fair share. But it wasn't like I had secrets all over the place. So what happens is I couldn't tell. My sponsor hated her, and she was telling me to break up with her. So I was mad at her all the time. And, you know, it was just freaking chaos. And so what happened was I wound up having to, you know, I had a breakup with her. And I look back now and I realize that not everyone in AA is healthy. And not everyone in AA is here for the good of AA. And I paid a very expensive lesson for that. And I'm very grateful that that's all I paid. It got to the point where I really wasn't going into work because there was so much chaos going on. I mean, you can't have chaos and a job. I mean, you have to choose. I was choosing the chaos. I also found out that you really are as sick as your secrets. And when I called my old sponsor and told her, and she's like, you know, you need to freaking call Linda and you need to tell Linda the truth. And I was like, what about this commitment? And, you know, and she's like, you know, this is just dry drunk. And so I wind up calling and telling Linda, and I know now if somebody needs to talk to me and they're going to pull me aside and they say, I have something really important to tell you, but you cannot tell anybody, I stop them right then and I say, if I cannot tell my sponsor, I do not want to know, because I am not going to be the holder of your bad behaviors that I have to now live with. So if I cannot tell my sponsor, I personally don't want to know. And it's been so good so far. So I wound it up, you know, Linda's like, you know, the next time you go to an AA meeting, I want you to volunteer for any job that is asked. And I'm like, you know, Linda, I don't need to volunteer my time. I need $2,000. That's what's going to fix my problems. I'm not volunteering my time. So she's like, that's not what I said. You said you were willing. And I'm like, well, you know, I am willing. And I remember a woman, her name was Aloma, and she said, you will come to a point in your sobriety. You're going to come to this crossroads. You're either going to decide to come and do it our way, or you're going to go back out. And I did not want to be that one person that goes all the way up to the pearly gates of heaven and meets Jesus and God and Mary and all the other people that are up there and find out that the steps work for everybody else in the freaking world except for you. So I did not want to be that person. So I said, grudgingly, I was willing. And so if you don't want your life to change, then don't pray. Because if you want your life to change, go ahead and pray. And you don't even have, you know, God, he's so funny. He doesn't mind if you give those sarcastic. I mean, God thought of sarcasm. You know, so even if you pray sarcastically, God takes that, changes it around, and whips it up into something wonderful. So So I start praying, and sure enough, the next freaking meeting I go to, and this woman, she says, they need people to work at the central office. And I was like, oh. You know, and so I put my hand up, and they send me down, and I don't know if you all know Helen, but Helen was down there at that time, and I go in there, and I had to be interviewed, and my sponsor had a vouch for me, and so I had to be there at 9 o'clock. And because, you know, this is a volunteer position, I am here to help them. So I show up at 9:15. And I would walk in, and Helen would say, the shift starts at 9 a.m. And I'm like, you know, I don't hear any thank yous in here. I am here at 9:15. So I work from 9:15, and I would stay till 11:30 because that's when my shift ended. And then I would run to a meeting because it was so overwhelming. I would go to the meeting, and then I started to realize that on Fridays, for the rest of the day, my day was good. And it was the first time in my life that I actually did not consume my thinking of me. Because from 9:15 to 11:30, I was thinking of other people. And that was one of the most amazing things that I had ever experienced. And so I have been a very big supporter of service work, and that's where I learned that. And so I wound up, you know, so of course, service work has served me well over the times of my entire sobriety, and I try to always be involved, and even though times get tough. So after that, I had like 3 years sobriety. I got diagnosed with breast cancer, and I was totally freaked out. And my sponsor, she'd be like, oh, it's okay. Just come on, let's just go to a meeting. And I'm like, I have breast cancer. I'm freaking out. She's like, oh, yeah, I know. Come on, let's just go to a meeting. And I'm like, you know, and I said to her in confidence, you know, Linda, I'm going to these meetings, and these people are really pissing me off because they're talking about some bullshit. I'm sorry. They're talking about some crap, and I'm fighting cancer. And she's like, you know, God, he's just so amazing. You know, this might be a good opportunity for you to learn compassion. I'm like, I have to learn compassion. She's like, well, listen to your tongue. You know. I'm like, so here I am. I'm going to meetings because I would go to these meetings, and I went to one meeting, and one guy, he was sitting there. He was torn up because he couldn't decide on one condo or the other condo. And I was like freaking losing my mind. And she's like, compassion, Maggie. This is where we're going to learn compassion. Because when life is going really good for you, Maggie, you don't seem to have compassion for other people because they're not irritating you. So when they're irritating you, that's when you need to have compassion. And I'm like, oh. So, and I can tell you that still rings today. I get so irritated over the most unbelievable stuff, and then I can hear, Maggie, this might be a good time to use compassion. So anyway, I wound up, you know, you all talked me going back to school. I went back to school. It took me 7 years. You add the original 4 that I got kicked out of. I went to school for 12 years for a 4-year degree. But, Maggie, we don't quit. We just keep going. It'll eventually end, Maggie. So it's actually been very, it's been an actually very good couple of years. And I would like to say that it's all been ups, you know, all great, but, you know, my sister passed away a couple of years ago, and that was really challenging. Even having time in sobriety, it was really very challenging. And I could still hear, because I would go to meetings, and people would irritate me, and I would still hear Linda's voice in my head, and I'd be like, you know, it'd probably be best if you just don't share. You can go, but just don't share. And so, but I, you know, I've gotten married in sobriety. Lori and I started dating when I, right after the crazy lady, and so I realized what a really decent person is, and that's what's kept my marriage together. And so I've been very blessed, and I'd like to say, I just turned 60 last month, and I'd like to say that this is probably the best my life has ever been. And it's all because of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I just want to give a quick rundown of my drinking career. Because, I don't really talk a lot about it. But I am 60. I was born in Brooklyn to an Irish Catholic family. And I have a sister who is 10 years older than I am. And I have a brother who is 14 years older than I am. And when I was 15 months old, my mom died very suddenly, and my dad had to make a really tough decision, and he decided to put me with my mother's sister. And so, we lived in a neighborhood, we all went to the same school, and we were one of those families that we were on every block kind of thing. And so, I stayed with my aunt. And I can't tell you, I don't remember any of it. I don't remember any memories of my mother. I don't remember any of that. But I can tell you, my resentment list started at that time. And I started a resentment list at the mere age of whatever. And when I got into recovery, and I had to try to explain those resentments, resentments don't mature. They stayed at the same rate when I got them. And when I created them, and I harbored them, and I host them, and I kept them safe. And so when I tried to explain it, it didn't even make sense. But, I was a child. But God, he's so funny. Sponsor number 5, I think, she said, I was like, we're coming up on this fourth step, and everyone's like, well, you got this fourth step, and you can't stay sober unless you do this fourth and fifth step, and, you need to ask God, and they're like, oh, God, blah, 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 God. And I'm like, God is the number one person, God is number one on my resentment list. And I don't know, and she's like, well, just ask God how to get past the resentment with God. And I'm like, that doesn't even make sense. It's like asking the lion how not to get eaten in the lion's den. And so she's like, yes, that's exactly what it means. So again, I started with the, she's like, pray. And I didn't want to assume I wasn't praying, so I prayed. And God is okay with sarcastic prayers. So off to praying I go, and the very next freaking meeting, here comes this woman. I've been sitting in these meetings for a while with her, and all of a sudden, she just blurts out my whole childhood. And I was like, wow, that's almost like kind of freaky. And so I wound up meeting her like the following week, and we wound up going over how she got past all of that. How did she able to turn and use God and get past that resentment? And she's like, well, I learned that not everything that happened is because I'm bad. I grew up thinking this all happened because I'm bad. And this happened because God doesn't like me. And, I had such, I was so distorted. And so she said, and I would love to say this, the only time I ever heard this in my sobriety, but this has come up multiple times. Not everything in your life that's happening is about you. And I'm like, how can this not be about me? So sure enough, but I tried. And that's what it says in the books. You gotta try. So I was willing to try. And so after that, my dad got remarried when I was 8. And he married a great woman, Regina, and she raised me. I loved her. I lost her a couple of years ago. Like almost 10 years now. She lived till she was 96, and we're talking like these were the people that they were all in World War II, and and she was on the switchboard at the day of Pearl Harbor. She worked at the AT&T, and so they just had a different view of life than we did. So Regina worked for AT&T, and we wound up getting transferred. Well, she got transferred to New Jersey. And so we went to New Jersey. We left Brooklyn, and our family acted like we were moving to Mars. I mean, New Jersey, I mean, those people don't even have sidewalks. And so we moved out to New Jersey, and if you know anything about Jersey, it's nothing like that now. So we moved to New Jersey, and then what happened was I went away to college, and that period of moving to New Jersey, my high school years, that was really probably the best time of my childhood. But then when I went away to college, my dad had gotten sick, and he passed away my freshman year. And when the doctor asked my Regina, what did she die of? How much did he drink? And she said, well, he drinks about 14 beers a day. And then he switches over to screwdrivers. And then he finishes up with Bloody Marys. And then we have dinner. And then he goes to bed. And he was like in shock, but, you know, our whole family drank like that, you know, and so we didn't have a liquor cabinet, we had a liquor closet, you know, so we were like a drinking family, and so everybody drank like that. So, you know, when I was coming up on my ninth step, there was this girl who said that she had run into this medium, and if you don't know what a medium, they're the people who like see the spirits on the other side, and like you could talk to them. And I was like, oh, man, that's what I want to do for my ninth step. And so, you know, so the same woman who told me about the crossroads and, you know, Miss Aloma, so I'm telling Miss Aloma this is a great plan. So I tell her, and I say, yeah, I'm going to go talk to this medium. I'll find out, do my ninth step, and, you know, and she's like, well, if you could talk to your father, what would you say? You know, and without thinking, I said, why did you have to drink so much? And she looked at me with this little, you know, West Virginia brogue and says, I don't think you're on step nine. And then I was like, so then right after that, I had this dream. And it was I dreamt and I saw my father in a mirror and he was talking and I couldn't hear him. And then so, and that was like it. And then I was telling one of my girlfriends, and they were, you know, at this time, they were all dream analysis people, and, you know, with the, anyway, so they were all into dreams. So I tell them this dream, and she said, oh, your father was in the mirror, and he was talking, but you didn't hear him? And I was like, yeah. And she's like, well, that's because you're not listening. I'm like, how is this my fault? It's always my fault. And she's like, well, obviously, you know, you're the one not listening. And then she said, you know, your father, he gave you a wonderful gift. And I was like, and what might that be? You know, here I am, 18, you know, he's, you know, drinks, and she said, you know, your father died of alcoholism, so you wouldn't have to. And then all those resentments just all started crumbling away. It was really kind of amazing. It gives me goosebumps today. And so, but, you know, I didn't learn how to deal with anything like that, you know, dealing with his death. And by the time, you know, college came to an end, everybody was graduating. And so I did the next best thing. And I joined the Marine Corps. And 2 weeks later, I was standing in Paris Island. And I will tell you, there is a, you know, the Marine Corps is not a big believer in free thinking. They are not. And so I did very well as long as I didn't talk. And so, of course, I thought they should hear my opinion because there really is better ways for them to do things. You know, seriously. Yeah. But so anyway, I wound up going to, I put in for orders to go to Japan. And I was, you know, I'm not a tall woman, you know, I used to be 5'8", now I'm 5'7½" or whatever, but, you know, it is what it is. So I'm 5'7", but, you know, the women in Japan, you know, even wearing heels are much shorter than I am. And so, you know, there's not many light-skinned, you know, at that time I had brownish hair, light brown hair and blue eyes. And so when I was out in, you know, out in town, you know, they would just openly touch me. They would just, you know, just grab me. And I'm like, you know, if somebody did that in New York, they would just kick your ass. You know what I'm saying? You gotta stop that. But you know, but they don't. Anyway, so a friend of mine, she wanted to take some pictures of the island, and it was a Sunday, and I said that I had a car. You know, it cost me $500. It was a Toyota 77 Corolla, and it was great. Okay, so. She gets this, so we're going to drive to the top end of the island. And if you don't know anything about Okinawa, it is it has very similar weather as Hawaii. You know, it's very tropical. So we take off, you know, of course, we've got to go with beer. So we had a cool, you know, we had a cooler of beer. And we drive to the north end of the island. And if you've never been to Okinawa, there's bases. There's military, Marine Corps bases, and there's one Air Force base. And all the way up at the north end of the island is not long at all. And it's like 69 miles. So we go to the top end of the island, and we go up to the base there, and it's the Marine Corps, it's the brig for the Marines. So there's no women at that base. So Blake and I drive up, and we just look like we just drove right out of a Gidget movie. Because they're laughing, and she's smoking, and we have music playing. And when we hit that front gate and those guards, they were so happy to see American girls. They were just like, yay! And so, but we had to go in and use the head, you know, and that's the bathroom. And so they didn't have a women's head at the gate there, so we had to go all the way into the base. And so we're driving, and we go down three blocks, over two blocks, and, you know, and so we go in and use the head, and I come out, and I'm sitting in the car, and Blake comes out after me, and, you know, military bases, and it's my opinion, military bases are decorated by military people, and they use the military stuff to decorate. Like, they use tanks and planes. You know, they're not much on, like, really pretty pictures. They're more into, like, war, okay? So we come, so out of the building, it's a tank, you know, it's lined with these bullets, and, you know, we call them rounds, and they were like 3-foot concrete, you know, in the shape of a bullet, and it was white, and it had a red stripe, and another white, and a red tip. As Blake comes walking out of the building, she decides she would like one, and so she picks up this concrete bullet and drags it over the car. And I personally think this is really funny. So I can't even get out and help her because it's just so funny. So instead of opening the back door, she picks it up and slides it into the window. And you can hear it's like, and I'm thinking this is even funnier. And so she gets in the car. And we're just like losing everything, you know. So we stop at the PX and I bought like some more beer, and she bought a bottle of Red Murray and Needy, which to me was sickening. I was like, how can, you know, whatever. So she starts drinking this twist off red wine, and I'm drinking my beer, and we get back and we're driving, and all of a sudden we hit all the, we hit all the traffic coming off the beaches, and we wound it up in traffic, and Blake passes out, you know, and I reached over, and if you know anything about me, if I am not a person who smokes cigarettes, I'm not. Actually, I was just telling my friends tonight that I was the friend in your group that would walk by with his, you know, scissors and cut your cigarette while you're smoking it. That's who I was, okay? So I don't have a history of smoking cigarettes. So I reach over to grab her cigarettes, and the car kind of went on its own and hit the car in front of us. And all of a sudden, these Japanese people are looking into the rearview mirror, and looking through the rearview window. And all of a sudden, they whipped open the door. And to me, it seemed like it was like the clown car. It just seemed like there were so many people pouring out of there. And I'm like, uh-oh. And so I'm trying to wake her up. And I'm like, you know, I get her. She's coming too. And I start talking to her like a Marine. And I'm like, Marine, I have a mission for you. Because, we have morals. We don't litter. So the whole back of the car is full of beer cans, for God knows how long. And so I wait, and she's looking at me, and I'm like, so she hops out, and she goes and takes, they probably still haven't done those beer cans. So the people come over to me, and they told me all the English that they knew, and it was MP. And I was like, oh, they're calling me MPs. So I'm like, So Blake comes back, and I'm like, and she's like, mission accomplished. And I looked at her, I was like, oh my God, I forgot you were even here. And so I'm leaning on the front, we're both leaning on the front of the hood of the car, and the Japanese police, they show up, and they call me over, and I go to take a step, and I tripped over Blake's feet, and she grabbed me before I was like, 6 inches before my face hit the ground, and we both froze, and she said, that was a really bad move. And I was like, I know. And then we stand up, and all of a sudden, all those Japanese policemen, they all started running around screaming. And I was like, this is not good. And so I know they don't know any English, and so, so they come over, and they want me to blow in this balloon. And I was like, I'm not blowing that freaking balloon. And I realized that they don't, so I started, if you ever travel abroad, and, Americans do not have good reputations because they think they're arrogant and obnoxious. And I want you to think of me because I helped build that reputation that day. I told them they could kiss my, I couldn't have been any nastier. And, I'm from Jersey, and it takes a lot to say that. So, finally the MPs show up, and they come over to me, and they're like, well, as I see it, you have two choices. And I'm like, you're damn right I got two choices. I'm American. And I'm like, what my choice? And he said, well, you can blow in that balloon here, or you can blow in it over in Japanese jail, because it really doesn't matter, because you're going to Japanese jail anyway. And I remember thinking, Marines, they stick together, they do everything together, so I freaking just start losing it. And Blake, she comes over, she starts losing it too, because we're Marines and we're together. So we're doing like that ugly girl crying, and like I'm talking, praying. Now we're in the middle of all this traffic, and everybody over off the beaches are coming past us. So we are quite the show. And so all of a sudden, I'm just praying out loud to God, take my stripe, I don't care, send me an American jail, it was a little drama. And so eventually the MP comes over and he's like, the police, the Japanese police have changed their mind, they don't want you. And then all of a sudden, Blake and I, we both I'm like wiping my tears away, and all of a sudden this wave of joy come over me, and we become giddy. And now we become obnoxious to the MPs, and so they are just, so they wound up having to transfer us from base to base to base to base. And by the time our base, who was at the other end of the island, had to come get us, it was at 9:30 at night. And the staff sergeant, he walks in, and he said, he walks over to us, and now we have been yelled at all day, and we laughed, and we were just having a great time ever since we found out I wasn't going to Japanese jail. And the staff sergeant, he comes over, and he said, how did I know when they said they had two women Marines here? How did I know one of them was you? And I was like, Staff Sergeant, what did I do? And, you know, over, and I had told this story, I can't tell you how many times. I've probably told it thousands of times. And it's been in the last, oh, I don't know, 10, 15 years that I can see the severity of the poor decision making that I made in my entire life. I mean, I put so many people's lives in jeopardy that day, and I did not really even give a crap. And today I realize that I don't want to be that person anymore. And so I did have to go to Japanese court, and the whole thing only costed like 70 American dollars because the yen was really good to the American dollar. So, and then from there I transferred to Paris Island, and I met people, and I wound up moving to Atlanta. So that pretty much sums up the whole cycle there. So I'm done, unless, of course, anybody has any questions. So I want to thank you, because I, you know, it's for people, even though I know nobody here except, of course, my friends, the posse here, that came up with me. And it's the people that have come to these rooms that have made the change that God was able to do for my life, and I'm very grateful. So thank you.
First I slip, and then I crib to a hope-filled dream. You rescue me, and finally, waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. Look into love's window for a heart that beats for me. Takes me where the promises are real. And I always long for something to set me free. Promises are real.